Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups for the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host the webinar, Military Academies Litigation After Students for Fair Admission, featuring John McLaughlin and Jack Park. Our moderator today is Devin Westill. Mr. Westill is the President and General Counsel for the Center for Equal Opportunity. Before that, he served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He has been published in Newsweek, National Review, and the Wall Street Journal. He has also provided testimony to both houses of Congress, the EEOC, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and as an expert witness in federal court. A graduate of UNC at Chapel Hill and the University of Florida, Mr. Westill is also a U.S. Navy veteran. If you would like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Mr. Westill, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thanks, Marco, and thanks to our speakers, Jack and John, for joining us. I'm going to try my best, as I mentioned to them before this call, not to talk too much. They are the real stars of the show today. But at the tail end of our program, we are going to allow the audience to provide your thoughts, your comments, your questions, and Jack and John have agreed to respond to those. What we want to talk about today is the litigation around the service academies and their race affirmative action programs that was launched after the Students for Fair Admissions decision by the Supreme Court last year. The Supreme Court, as you'll recall, ruled last year that Harvard and UNC's race affirmative action programs violated both the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and Title VI of the Civil Rights Act 1964. The Center for Equal Opportunity, the organization that Marco mentioned that I run as president and general counsel, filed and joined several briefs in litigation in support of petitioner Students for Fair Admissions, SFFA, and opposing race preferential treatment at Harvard and UNC. The decision has been interpreted by and large as a prohibition on the use of race as a factor in admissions at Harvard and UNC and other selective colleges and universities with similar affirmative action programs, except, as footnote 4 makes clear from the opinion, the ruling does not apply to military academies. The Center for Equal Opportunity CEO also opposes consideration of race and selection of cadets at the service academies, believing, among other reasons, that the court's legal analysis and logic from SFFA, the SFFA cases, applies equally to the service academies. That reasoning being that, one, similar to Harvard and UNC, the service academies do not operate their race-based admissions programs in a manner that's sufficiently measurable for judicial review. Secondly, that they violate the twin commands, that race not be used as a stereotype or a negative. And three, that the programs lack any meaningful endpoints. Thinking similarly, Students for Fair Admissions, the same group that sued Harvard and UNC, sued the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and the U.S. Naval Academy over their race-based admissions programs. As the government in the Harvard and UNC cases made clear in their brief and in oral argument, the issue of affirmative action in the service academies affects the pipeline of the military officer corps and therefore implicates national security and military readiness issues. These concerns have been debated for decades, including in a highly influential brief filed by retired high-level military officials in the 2003 Grutter versus Bollinger decision, which was the decision that solidified in the law the diversity rationale, the idea that the educational benefits that flow from a diverse student body permitted the use of race in affirmative action admissions programs at colleges and universities. And that brief was quoted in the court's opinion at the time in the Grutter case. The Harvard and UNC cases saw competing briefs on the merits of affirmative action in the service academies as well. But what now? Where do we stand on the current litigation against the service academies? use of race in admissions. Will the practice survive the current lawsuits? If not, are there still ways to racially diversify the academies and the military? Should that even be a goal? Here to help us sort out some of these questions, to discuss the litigation, and also to talk about all things under the sun in terms of a diversity in the military and in the service academies are Jack Park and John McLaughlin. I'm going to introduce them very briefly. As Marco mentioned, they have much longer bios. They agreed to the shorter version here. Jack will go first. So let me say that Jack served on active duty as an Army JAG for 4.5 years and in the Army Reserves as individual mobilization augmentee assigned to the Army JAG school. There, he assisted the criminal trial advocacy, instruction, and other matters. His reserve time ended in 1998. From 2019 to 2024, Jack served in the Georgia State Defense Force. After serving on active duty, Jack worked for what is now Bradley Aaron Bolt Cummings in Birmingham, then for the state of Alabama as a deputy and assistant attorney general. Then he moved to Washington, D.C., where he served as special assistant to the inspector general for the Corporation for National and Community Service. Jack spent a year as a visiting legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation before moving to Georgia. There he worked with Strickland Brockington Lewis as a sole practitioner, and as general counsel for Indigo Energy. Jack is the author of numerous amicus briefs and published articles and other materials, and is a graduate of the University of Virginia and the Yale Law School. John McLaughlin currently serves as Special Projects Officer with the National Guard Bureau. His duties include oversight of the investigation of whistleblower allegations and the development and delivery of training on ethics. John was previously counsel at Cause of Action, a nonprofit law firm dedicated to government transparency. He also teaches as an adjunct professor at the University Maryland Global Campus and previously taught an honor seminar at Virginia Military Institute. His military career began in intelligence and included deployments to both Iraq and Afghanistan, along with working across Europe. He then attended the University of Virginia School of Law and transferred to the JAG Corps and to the DC National Guard, where he mobilized during the summer 2020 civil unrest and after the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. He lives in Washington, D.C. with his wife, the artist M.K. Bailey, and recently authored his first book, How to Deal with Damn Near Anything, The Paratrooper's Guide to Life. He is here today in his personal capacity. It's important for you to know that his views do not represent the Department of Defense nor any of its components. Again, we'll have some Q&A after the remarks by Jack and by John. So have your questions ready or comments for which they can respond. Let's start off with you, Jack.
Thank you, Devin, and thanks to the Federalist Society and the Civil Rights Practice Group for the opportunity to participate in this webinar. As with John, the views expressed that I express are my own and should not be attributed to Indigo Energy, where I now work, or to any other affiliate of mine. I'm not really up to speed on some of the litigation. I understand that the case against the United States Naval Academy is now pending decision in the U.S. District Court for Maryland. I'm not sure about the case against the U.S. Military Academy. What I'd like to do is talk briefly about the Students for Fair Admissions decision. And as Devin said, in that case, the Supreme Court held that the admissions programs of Harvard and the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill violated the Equal Protection Clause insofar as they considered race. And the court said that basically racial classifications are subject, as we know, to strict scrutiny. They have to further compelling governmental interests, and they must be narrowly tailored to serve those interests. And it quoted its 2016 in Fisher versus University of Texas and explained, we have required that universities operate their race-based admissions programs in a manner that is sufficiently measurable to permit judicial review. And Devin referred to the fact that the military academies are not directly covered by this decision. In footnote 4, the court observed, the United States' amicus curiae contends that race-based admissions programs further compelling interests at our nation's military academies. No military academy is a party to these cases, however, and none of the courts below address the propriety of race-based admissions systems in that context. This opinion does not address the issue in light of the potentially distinct interests that military academies may present. One would think that if they present substantially the same or the same interests, they would run into the same problems that the court pointed to in Students for Fair Admissions. And Harvard in Students for Fair Admissions said that it wanted to train future leaders, prepare graduates to adapt to an increasingly pluralistic society, better educated students through diversity, and produce new knowledge stemming from diverse outlooks. UNC said much the same. It wanted to promote the robust exchange of ideas, broaden and refine understanding, foster innovation and problem solving, prepare graduates for citizenships and enhance appreciation, respect, and empathy, cross-racial understanding, and break down stereotypes. The problem for the court, which saw these goals as commendable, was that there's no way to measure whether they've been achieved. As the court said, how is a court to know whether leaders have been adequately trained, whether the exchange of ideas is robust, or whether new knowledge is being developed? Even if these goals could somehow be measured, moreover, how is a court to know when they have been reached and when the perilous remedy of racial preferences may cease? There is no particular point at which there exists sufficient innovation and problem solving, or students who are appropriately engaged and productive. And if your pursuit is diversity, it's a never-ending pursuit simply because you graduate in the colleges one quarter of your cohort every year. So you're, as time goes on, you're going to have to do continual balancing to achieve the diversity that you think is necessary. And all that plays into what you want our military to be. Should it be the best, most effective, most cohesive, and most lethal force achievable? If so, the question is whether the justifications that the Naval Academy and the U.S. Military Academy advance are narrowly tailored to achieve those goals. And the government justifications are similar to those advanced in SFFA. It pointed to fostering cohesion and lethality in military units, helping recruit and retain a first-class officer corps, maintaining diversity, which helps lead a multicultural force and fight alongside diverse partners and allies, maintain public trust in the military and enhance the military's legitimacy in the eyes of the nation and the world. In an article, Paul Larkin, Cully Stimson, and Thomas Spohr, all of whom are at Heritage, they note, in any group enterprise, cohesion results from a shared mission, demonstrated respect for each individual, and proven equal treatment, none of which is promoted by favoritism, and especially racial favoritism in 2024. If soldiers fight for the man or woman on their right or left, and how hard they fight, and whether they can persevere through the hardships that those in the Army are asked to endure, depends to a considerable degree on the cohesion of their team. Any racial discrimination would be corrosive. And some of the other justifications, you know, when do we know we've got a first-class officer corps? When do we know that diversity helps us fight alongside diverse partners and allies? When do we know we have public trust? I think that comes from surveys, and we enhance the military's reputation in the country. Another thing point that I'd make at this stage is that I'm not sure the preferences are necessary. In the ongoing litigation, I understand that the government has not taken the position that ROTC programs at these at the private schools and universities is not covered by SSFA. And those programs produce more than 80% of the officer accessions, and only some of the 33% of the general officers who come from the service academies. Some 33% of the general officers come from the service academies. And from my experience at the JAG school, I imagine there's some ring knocker bias going on. But, you know, and also if you look at some noteworthy general officers, General Colin Powell was an ROTC graduate of CCNY. Marine General Joseph Dunford is a graduate of St. Michael's College in Colchester, Vermont. And Navy Admiral William McRaven graduated from the University of Texas. And so too with graduates of historically Black colleges and university ROTC programs like Prairie View A&M, which graduated Army Lieutenant General Julius Becton, and Tennessee State University Air Force General Lloyd Newton. At those schools, at that time, the classes were unlikely to be diverse in the way that Harvard and UNC thought they should be. So at the end of the day, I think that the justifications advanced by the military and the need for the preferences mean that the programs, any consideration of race and admissions at the service academy should be jettisoned. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jack. We're going to turn it over to John here in just one second. I want to remind the audience that we will have an opportunity for question and answer. So queue up those questions in the Q&A function of the Zoom chat, and we'll get to those at the tail end of our panelists' introductions. So, John, if you could take it away.
Certainly. And apologies, there appears to be some kind of emergency going on outside. It does not involve me, but if you do hear sirens and other noise, apologies for the distraction. So I want to echo Jack's thank you for the invitation and for the opportunity to discuss these things, and echo his disclaimer about being here purely in my professional capacity and not on behalf of any employer, past, present, or future. So thank you for that. So briefly to frame my thoughts, you may hear me throw a few pieces of rotten fruit at the SFFA decision, but I'm not in any manner trying to bring the holding into question, not at all. If I do raise some annoyances with its reasoning or its clarity, it's only in service of discussing this application of it to this other context. So not bringing into question the holding of SFFA at all, just its application here. Also, I do not have, in addition to being in my personal capacity, I don't have any connection with military academies. I have not taught at or attended one. As you mentioned, I did teach at VMI, which for anyone not familiar is sort of a smaller scale attempt at a civilian equivalent to a martial education, if not affiliated with the military, where about half of the students do go on to become military officers. But my own career actually began with 10 years as an enlisted soldier, which I'll get into when relevant moving forward. So with that out of the way, there's two things I want to cover as my part of the conversation today. First is a quick overview of military readiness. And that phrase is chosen specifically because I suggest it as a framework to sort of couch the potentially distinct interests that the court alluded to in footnote four. So number one, military readiness. Number two, I want to sprint through an analysis of the question of military academy policies in the light of SFFA, including some of the language that Jack mentioned, along with one or two notes from the complaint that was filed in the case against the U.S. Military Academy, aka the Army Officer School specifically. Don't worry, I won't get too weeds into the weeds on the complaint. If you haven't read it, don't worry. I'm just going to hit one or two of the highlights that I think are relevant here. So those are the two areas I want to cover. First of which, military readiness. So you may or may not have heard that phrase before. The complaint in the Army case does use it as a section title, but the phrase military readiness is not mentioned afterwards. It's not defined or analyzed, which I thought was unfortunate because readiness as a term and as a philosophy really is the linchpin of military operations, both in practice and on paper in terms of the doctrine that the military follows. So what is military readiness? Why bring it up now? How is that relevant to these issues? So military readiness requires creating a unique, entire, self-sufficient, self-contained ecosystem that can include people from their first day in the organization to their 30th or 40th year in the organization. And this ecosystem has to be movable to anywhere on the planet with basically no notice and perform any number of tasks from building schools and clinics to, of course, sometimes killing people. So I'm sure that many folks here are familiar with the distinct legal interests that result from the military readiness necessity. Whether it's how the military has its own legal system or its own justice system to enforce those laws, how that system needs to do things like make adultery illegal, which is particularly interesting these days, and how it is allowed to use extraordinarily vague terms, things like conduct unbecoming of an officer, as a means to prosecute people or to level the equivalent of a significant civil judgment against them. Can you imagine a civilian equivalent where you could do conduct unbecoming of a citizen, and that was the only thing the government needed to bring charges against you? That's how the military operates and the interests that it's recognized to have. So in addition to that legal latitude, which I think a fair number of folks here would be familiar with, I want to zoom out and talk about how the military has to have social latitude and to create this self-sustaining, effective society in which every tier of that society is exclusively drawn from within. So we don't do lateral hires. And whereas universities can have students that come from or go anywhere and leaders that can come from or go anywhere, the exact opposite is the case for military academies, where every academy graduate has a mandatory service requirement. And those graduates will not just work in this parallel society, but they live in it and they lead in it and they make life or death decisions for everyone else in that society. Military leaders get to peer into the most granular and intimate details of everything from haircuts to religious clothing to your body fat percentage to how well your marriage is going. All of these things are fair game for military leaders if it affects readiness. And often academy graduates will make these decisions based or over people, affecting people that they don't have a lot in common with. Because for all of the shared parts of the military experience, enlisted soldiers and officers live and work in different worlds. And I say that having been both of those things. So every means that the military has to foster links between those tiers of its internal society has real and significant value for increasing readiness. So that ecosystem also comes with some downsides, necessary as it is. And I want to briefly touch on two of those downsides. First is a lack of connection to the civilian world and understanding by the civilian world. This is sometimes referred to as the military-civilian divide. And by any number of metrics by which that's measured, it's been getting significantly worse over the past 20 years or so. And the military is very, very fortunate to be highly respected. But highly respected does not always mean highly understood, which leads to the court's at least allusion to distinct interests in this case, its allowance of distinct practices in other legal areas. And I think it leads to some of the oversights in the complaint in the Army case particularly. But the second danger I want to mention of this ecosystem, and the largest danger and the biggest threat to military readiness overall, is groupthink. It is not China, it is not Russia. Homogeneity is easily, in my opinion, the most dangerous weakness of the US military and can be directly blamed for its greatest strategic failures. And that is why academy leadership and military leadership as a whole is focused on diversity, not because of fads or trends or arbitrary metrics, but as a function of readiness. Military leaders come from a limited number of sources. And by far, the most focused and dedicated of these sources are the military academies. And as these leaders remain in the force over years and over decades, they often self-select out of the military because of the narrowness of the experience, because they feel like they do not have sufficient support, sufficient ties to those around them, above and below them. And that type of narrowness that pushes, has been shown to push people out of the military, is significantly worsened the more homogenous the force is. Because the military can be a figuratively and literally isolating experience. And the presence of leaders that enlisted personnel can relate to, can connect to, who have a shared background with, is, in my experience, absolutely crucial to attracting and retaining and training a sufficient number and sufficient caliber of soldiers to maintain a fully ready military, to have that ecosystem. If you were to select on paper the 100 most qualified people for the top 100 spots in any military organization, it would implode within a month, because it has to be a complementary ecosystem of people It cannot just be a murderer's row in the way the nine best athletes are on a sports team, who may go their nine separate ways when the game is over. This ecosystem has to cohere as a whole. So that's my first half, is hopefully a quick summary of military readiness that added a few details to the distinct interests that may relate to this case. So number two, some of the high points of SFFA and how they might apply here, whether the court does or does not, which there's no reason it has to as a whole or not recognize distinct interests. It could take an a la carte approach to whether distinct interests do or do not exist. And I want to hit on how it might do so here. So first, as Jack mentioned, focused and measurable objectives were an emphasis of the court and SFFA in terms of being necessary to support any kind of race-related policy. The first example the court gives of an acceptable use of these policies, an acceptable objective, is prison. Now, I'm not saying the military is like prison, but it is a closed and specific ecosystem where people are very, very, very close to each other for unusually long periods of time, and where harmony amongst those people is necessary for the institution to function. So it may seem ridiculous to compare what is hopefully still one of the most highly respected organizations and groups of people in America with perhaps not as highly respected a group of people in the inmate population. But there's three things I want to suggest there. One, believe it or not, there are roughly as many people in jail as there are in the military in America, which raises some other questions. But I mention that here because if one seems vast and one seems a very granular application, they're not necessarily different, because number two, the military is just a collection, ultimately, of squads and teams that most frequently number in the single digits. So we may be familiar with the Pentagon and its budget and the vastness of the enterprise as a whole. But when it comes down to what actually happens day to day, it's a small number of people interacting with a small number of people in the decisions they make. And then last, in contrast to universities, where numbers vary, but over 60% of people currently go to college, fewer than 1% join the military, fewer than that become officers, and fewer than that attend service academies. So obviously the military is not prison. So overall, when it comes to focused and measurable objectives, I think military objectives fall somewhere between the extremely vague language trotted out by universities in this case, and the very specific warden trying to keep a discrete group of inmates from killing each other. So what would the military's options look like for finding an objective that's sufficiently measurable and focused to satisfy the court here, should the court not offer to recognize a distinct interest? The most obvious one is the makeup of the enlisted force. Whereas the universities, including the language Jack cited regarding cultivating leaders, they just release their charges back into the wild to hopefully thrive, excuse me, possibly to never interact with the university or its ecosystem ever again. And the military, it can anchor its goals to the majority of and the remainder of its organization, which is the enlisted force. So I think this is sufficiently coherent to qualify as a compelling interest, according to the court's language, but it is still very much tied to race, so it may not qualify. What else could the military look to? I think because of the size and some of the other factors I mentioned, it's a single organization with a single concrete mission. The military could hang its hat on some more focused and measurable things. You've got retention, promotion, training metrics, recognition for command positions, awards. There's a detailed and longstanding infrastructure to assess command climate. I'm not saying any of these are automatically going to pass muster, but the military does have options universities don't, because it's taking the people it's training and putting them into a very specific, focused professional context instead of just saying, we made you the best people we can, good luck. So the decision also mentions, I wanted to raise one more issue there. The military also has metrics regarding its objectives on disciplinary proceedings and military justice, which could be related to what the court says are acceptable uses of these policies in terms of workplace discrimination or remedial action. Some of the other examples given of acceptable uses of these policies. They're not an exact match for either, so I'm not saying it's a one-for-one comparison, but the military does have objectives which touch on the same areas as acceptable examples the court gave of allowable uses of these policies. So that's it for focused and measurable objectives. Briefly, two more. Meaningful connection is a phrase the court uses is requiring here. Honestly, the court kind of rambles here and just kind of says that more exacting racial categories are better and calls out the poor attorney who argued it for not knowing how the Jordanian students were categorized. It's kind of a gotcha question. I don't think it provides a lot of useful guidance for the rest of us. The best language I could find is that the court wants an exceedingly persuasive justification. Very broad language. I would just point back to the justifications I mentioned in terms of readiness as perhaps the best shot the military would have for satisfying this exceedingly persuasive justification. I say test, it's not that organized, but language that the court used. And the last SFFA related thing is negative slash stereotype. And here I would suggest people consider that acknowledging the drawbacks of a homogenous force in the military is not a negative stereotype about whatever shared characteristic happens to form that homogeneity, nor is it a negative statement about any of the individuals that happen to have that characteristic. If we had a bunch of guys who were 6'8" join the military, I couldn't run submarines anymore. I probably couldn't run a lot of helicopters anymore. There's a distinct operational connection. But the court has gone in the direction of treating homogeneity as, what's the best way to say this, as saying that the desire to not have homogeneity is a stereotype against whoever forms that largest portion of the group. And that is not, one does not necessarily flow from the other there. And I want to build on that by going to the complaint real quick, which talks about trust. And I think it's relevant, even though it wasn't in the SFFA decision, because it is something I commonly hear used to discuss these issues. Trust is not what the complaint says, and the reason I bring this up, is that it is a pernicious negative racial stereotype to assume that people will be distrustful of those of a different race. But what I want to encourage people to think of in terms of the justification for this type of policy is that trust is not a binary. It is not a one or a zero. So in order to justify this type of policy, you do not have to say, I trust people who look like me. I am suspicious of people who don't. Trust, and the military has done a lot of research into trust, as have other types of organizations that function in small teams. Trust is ultimately a function of shared experience, of gradual understanding. We've all had experiences where we walk into a room where we don't know anyone, and we start looking for commonalities, things we might have that we can use as an anchor to relate to people. The military, because of the amount of movement and upheaval that comes with the military career, the military is that room full of strangers over and over again. So the degree to which a shared background, to include that of race, can be used as a metric to build leadership shortens the distance between people to hasten that process of trust building. It is not an either or. It does not involve a negative stereotype. It is simply an issue of finding someone you have something in common with to begin the building of that process, not to the exclusion of building it with others. So last thing I will say, and then how am I doing on time, Devin? Apologies for not looking. I'm doing all right. All right. I got one quick story if I have time for it. I'm not trying to get too ambitious here. Well, I want to wrap up my main remarks with this. There has been an unfortunate strain of thought that has been gaining some credence that views the military as ideally the gruffest, buffest, toughest, most taciturn looking dudes that you can possibly find. And unfortunately, we've had some elected officials share literal Russian propaganda advertising that as the military ideal. Nothing could be further from the truth. There is no one military ideal. Diversity, and I don't use it in the context exclusively of racial or ethnic background, but diversity in a broader sense is the linchpin to military success. If you had 100 of me, and I think I've done a fairly good job when I've been in the military, it would be a disaster for most units. The diversity interests of the military are unique because of the readiness interests that I mentioned earlier. So this idea that's pushed of this one particular archetype of soldier, often drawn from certain parts of the military, from certain people, is an incomplete and dangerous way of viewing the ideal way to construct a military force. And I lied. Last thing. I want to caution people against there's been an emergence of sort of a utopian jurisprudence where it is court decisions and laws made for the world as we wish it were. Specifically with Justice Thomas's concurrence in SFFA talks about his enduring hope that people will function a certain way. The very existence of a military, the very existence of law, is a recognition that people are not, in fact, like that. And I do not want us to be in a position where we're structuring a military based on hope or based on the world as we wish it were. I wish that people were able to find those commonalities with anyone without having to use the shortcuts. If I see somebody in a hat from where I went to college, that's a shortcut. It doesn't have to be about race. And I wish those shortcuts weren't necessary. And we could have a panopticonic vision into everyone, and we would be able to make those assessments. But in the world, as it is, shared background plays a factor in trust, and allowing that to play a factor in how the military admits people into its service academies is just a recognition of that fact. It is not necessarily endorsement of it or a negative stereotype about anyone else. So do I have time for the one quick story, or am I good?
Let's have Jack respond.
Jack, not watching the clock. I'm trying to mute when the sirens are going
out. No problem at all. I want to make sure that we get our questions in from the audience as well. So once again, I see some populating in our Q&A chat. Go ahead and put them there. Jack, up to 5 minutes to respond to anything you heard from John. And then right before we go to Q&A, we're going to hear a real fun story from John.
Okay, I'll be quick. You know, I agree that, you know, the military readiness is an important consideration, and it's based on deployability. You have to be ready to go at any time. And the folks who have to be most ready to go in the Army are the 82nd at what was Fort Bragg and the 101st at what may still be Fort Campbell. But it all turns on leadership, and I don't think leadership is necessarily distributed equally among all people. I'm probably a better staffer than a leader. But that said, where do our officers come from? They come from OCS, Officer Candidate School, enlisted folks who are trained to become officers. They come from ROTC programs throughout the country, which are subject to SFFA, and they provide, and between them, they provide more than 80% of all the officer accessions. And then about 18% of folks come from the academies. And the goal in the military is to develop leadership skills in your officer corps and in your senior listed corps. And again, you know, that turns on the qualities of each individual. And they're not, I think they're randomly distributed throughout all the races. Now, that's fine, but you've got to recruit people to do the job. And I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Jack. John, if we could just hear your story, we'll go into our Q&A
portion. Thank you. So I don't know if anyone knows the place that produces the highest per capita number of service members. You could view as the most patriotic, the most willing to serve. It is not in the South or the Rust Belt. It is American Samoa. Right? And I don't know if anyone's had a chance to visit or work with people who are from the Pacific Islands, but it is a distinct and amazing culture. Now, unsurprisingly, the military has physical standards, which until recently involved body height and weight. Based off your age and your height, you could only weigh X number of pounds. You could be the strongest, the fastest, the toughest person ever walked the earth. But if you weighed 180 pounds and you're only allowed to weigh 178, you were out of the military. So Samoans do not look like 90s fitness models, right? No matter how much they exercise. So we were throwing out Samoans from the military for decades because they were unable to meet these height and weight standards. Until finally, approximately 2 years ago, the Army at least instituted a policy where if you got a minimum physical fitness score, your weight didn't matter. I cannot tell you for sure. I did my research. I could not find a Samoan general. So I cannot speak to, and I don't want to promise that if we'd had one magical leader, they would have prevented this from happening. But I did want to offer it as an example of the unique interests of the military having to take this all-encompassing approach to managing every different potential type of person. And I guarantee you that if there had been more of a voice, a diverse voice in leadership, we would have not chaptered out, kicked out the hundreds of capable, tough, physically fit soldiers because they did not fit a stereotype of what a narrow, homogenous set of leaders thought a soldier should look like. That's the story.
Very much, John. I appreciate that. And thank you, Jack, for your thoughts as well. What we'll do now, audience, is go to your questions. But I wanted to respond to a couple of things that I heard to get things started, and then I'll move over to our Q&A function. The first is, there's a ton that I I get into. Let me first ask about this, John, and then Jack, I want to know your thoughts on this too, if you're willing to share them. John suggests that diversity is the linchpin of the military or to military readiness. I think there may be a difference there. So if I'm not quoting exactly, let me know, John. My question there for you, John, is if that's fine, is it possible to achieve the diversity that you think is important to military readiness, that readiness ecosystem that you described, without affirmative action and college and university admissions? I mean, we already don't have that now after SFFA, but if we extended that to the service academies, would we still be able to get the diversity that you think is important, is in fact the linchpin you suggested to military readiness? And then also, Jack, you know, I was just going to ask if you agree with that statement, that diversity is the linchpin of the military to military readiness. John,
I agree on one. Just like the term liberal can mean different things depending on how philosophical your conversation partner is, I mean diversity completely. I'm talking city boys and country girls. I'm talking tall and short and different types of intelligence, people with different levels of education. I'm talking all-encompassing diversity, not just Title VI or VII or even nine type of diversity. So I stand by the statement with the broadest possible definition of diversity. I've been surprised in my time in the military with where talent came from, and it taught me a lot about what talent looks and sounds like, things I didn't know previously. So yes, I endorse the statement so long as it's read that way. As to whether these policies are necessary to have that diversity, I'm not sure. I would like to think there are other ways, frankly. I do not want to feel like this policy or any one policy is required to give us the leadership we need. I do think this policy contributes towards achieving that variety, I'll call it, since diversity has a lot of other contexts, to achieving that variety in leadership. That mandate might not be enough to save it legally. Now, it may have to be, in order for the court to see it as justified to use this type of admissions policy, they may need to be convinced it is necessary. I'm not sure that's the case, but I do think it is justified by diverse interests, and I do think it contributes to that variety. But no, I definitely stop short of saying it is bedrock. Now, I'm not saying it's not required. I'd have to do a little more digging. But as things stand, no, I don't think that the variety of military leadership rests on this policy, just that it's contributed to by this policy.
Thank you very much, John, for your thoughts and for elaborating there as well. It sounds like you're a fan of true diversity, sort of a very broad definition of what diversity actually meant before maybe just a few years ago. And I appreciate
absolutely
your thoughts. Yeah, I appreciate your thoughts on that. One of the reasons why, Jack, I wanted to also pose that question to you, diversity being a linchpin of the military, is that I think a fair amount of people might argue, well, actually, it's not diversity that's the linchpin of the military. What's the linchpin of the military is that we agree on certain things, that we act in lockstep, and that's the thing that makes the military great. In fact, I've said it before that the military is the most egalitarian place I've ever served. And we wore a uniform for a reason. A sailor was a sailor, not black or white. A Marine was Marine, not Christian or Jew. And to some extent, you know, that goes too far. The people and their brains and their experiences are underneath that uniform. But what say you, Jack, in terms of this suggestion that diversity is the linchpin of military readiness?
I agree that the military comes from the members of the military come from a lot of different parts of the country. But again, as you said, Devin, I think the military is thoroughly egalitarian, and the cream should rise to the top. And frequently it does. And I think that's the best way to think about true diversity. And basically what happened in the universities was they got the opportunity to use diversity in their admissions programs, and they kept telling the court, trust us, and the court finally developed distrust for the way in which the universities were using their diverse considerations.
Thank you very much, Jack. And what I'll do now is go to some of the questions that I see queued up in our chat, and would love to get the responses from our panelists on those. The first is, and I'm going to expand a little bit on this, actually, is if legislation were enacted prohibiting the consideration of race in admissions to the service academies, would that render these two lawsuits against the Naval Academy and against West Point moot, such that they would be possibly dismissed? One thing I wanted to add to the back end of that, to the extent that two of you have any thoughts on legislation here, is that you know, we had an election recently, and the Republicans swept, actually, in a trifecta, the House, the Senate, and also the presidency. And so there, this question is actually really timely and important to think about in the context of these cases, as is the selections by President-elect Trump of a number of positions in his cabinet, but for our purposes, for Secretary of Defense. At the Department of Defense, he selected Pete Hegseth, a veteran who, from what I can tell in my own, I admittedly cursory research, is not a fan of DEI in the military and those sorts of things that I think affirmative action could be wrapped into. Your thoughts on whether or not legislation, if it were enacted, to prohibit race-conscious admissions would moot these cases, and whether or not in sort of unilateral executive action, the Department of Defense could put it into consideration of race in admissions at the service academies.
Well, for my part, I think I doubt that legislation would be involved. I do think, though, that the administration and the Department of Defense could limit the consideration of race at the academies if it's a chose.
Agreed. And based off the previous statements of incoming leadership, I don't think anyone should be surprised if things go in that direction.
Very good. Here's another interesting question. I think it's mainly directed towards some thoughts that John shared. John, what and of course, Jack, please respond if you have some thoughts as well. What evidence exists to support the government's claim in these cases that officer enlisted racial demographic parity is, quote, essential to national security? Could you point us towards something like that? John, have you seen the evidence?
The question was blocking my mic, so I had to make sure I wasn't muted and started talking. The record hasn't really been developed yet. And as somebody who has not worked on these issues specifically, I can't say. So I will say that the current policy was set without having to answer these kinds of questions. So to some degree, it's TBD as to whether which direction the more granular analysis will point in. Obviously, phrases like essential to national security are themselves broad. I already mentioned some of the language. That's the law, right? At least at the beginning point. So I don't think the record's been sussed out enough for us to know the answer to that question quite yet.
I agree, although I do think that, find my thought. You know, one thing I was going to say is the Army was segregated until 1947 when Truman desegregated. And we've had a number of 80 plus years or almost 80 years under that regime. And so too of the other academies, other services. And so I think they have become racially diverse and over time. And it's just something where everybody has learned that they can contribute.
Let me mention one thing briefly that I thought of. I do want to, I'm not saying this answers the question, but I do want people to take into account when asking these types of questions that the military faces atrophy over time that allows it to not change the way things are with the quickness that another organization could. If I discover, for example, one survey showed that one out of 124 colonels in part of the military justice system was Black. I'm not arguing on behalf of a specific number, but I do think one is a problem. Now, whether you do or do not think it's a problem, if the military does, or let's say it's not even Earth, let's say we have one that came from a particular type of law school or one that has a particular type of legal experience, we cannot pull in people to fill those gaps. We only can grow our own from within. And that's what makes academies and initial accession a particularly important issue for the military, since we can't fill our ranks later, even if we discover we don't have enough patent lawyers. Like, we cannot just bring those in from the outside. So something to consider why academies play a particularly important role here, or initial accession does.
Yeah, the thought I missed was, you know, I think it's unlikely that there will be much in the way you can demonstrate a connection between some of these considerations and national security. It will be more an assertion than something you can actually demonstrate.
Thank you very much.
That's the instinct.
We have a few additional questions, but I want to follow up on something John just mentioned. John, you suggested that having sort of one racial minority in certain leadership positions would be a problem. Maybe the audience doesn't think it's a problem, but you would find it as a problem. I'm just curious if you could unpack that a little bit for us. What exactly is the problem with that in your view?
Certainly, I can speak to that in some more details on that example specifically. So what ends up happening is, this is particularly in the military justice system. So the survey that was done that revealed that fact also showed that racial minorities were much more likely to be investigated for the same behavior as white service members were. Okay. So now I have this fact. Who is going to be a credible discusser of this fact? Who's going to be able to reach out to the troops and talk about the experiences that people go through? Who are the troops going to trust to come talk about those experiences? If I'm a minority service member, and let's say it's not a racial minority, I was an enlisted soldier with a degree. So that meant that people might come to me for something they wouldn't go to someone else for. It is useful because, as the service academies noted, although I'm not speaking on their behalf, people want to approach, especially if they have a complaint or they're worried about what they're going to say affecting their career, they want to approach people who will understand the concern they have. So they want to approach people who have been in a similar situation. I've went to Iraq and Afghanistan. If people have questions about Iraq and Afghanistan, they're going to come to me, and they may, that our numbers are getting fewer and fewer in terms of active duty service members. So it's more about having a shared experience. Race is one of many shared experiences people can have, but it is one. It is a meaningful one. And to the extent that we have such near zero representation in leadership, concerns that are related to those things, concerns which are shown to have been a problem objectively in terms of how the justice system treats people, people aren't going to bring those concerns forward if they're worried that they're not going to be found to be credible, and they're more likely to have those concerns if they have to go to people who will have never gone through that themselves. That was long-winded, but hopefully I gave some idea of why it's important operationally, not morally, not philosophically, but operationally.
Well, I think it's a fair point, one that doesn't get a lot of attention. We've got a few more questions, but I was just going to respond that, you know, I think for a lot of people, race does matter to them. And so, you know, I take your point, John. Certainly, I do think that, you know, being a combat zone veteran or what have you probably matters. It has more weight for why people might seek your counsel within the service than what your race is or what your ethnicity is. But those things do matter to people. My question and follow up to that for both you and Jack is, to the extent that that is true, let's just put aside whether or not it is or not, short of you know, allowing the service academies to continue to operate in the way that it is with its race affirmative action admissions programs, what ways do you think legally the court might allow as a distinct sort of carve out for service academies to seek diversity within within those schools, race neutral alternatives, for example, using proxies in some way that it did not allow for Students for Fair Admissions. Any thoughts there,
Jack?
The Students for Fair Admissions carve out was through essays demonstrating somehow that you overcame obstacles And that remains to be seen what the colleges and universities will do with that. But I think, you know, just again, leadership is distributed across races and people, and we just need to let the cream rise to the top and have confidence that it will.
I think the most likely would be twofold. One, the tide of the enlisted force. The military is bringing in specific people to do a specific job over a specific other group of people. And that the operational performance of those people is going to be meaningfully degraded if the gap opens too wide between the shared experience of, and again, I would have the same problem if we took nothing but, no offense to Yale or UVA where I went to law school, if we took nothing but folks from there, you'd run into some of the same issues. So that's what I think would be the most likely thing, is the tie to the enlisted force and the practical day-to-day leadership that the officer corps has to provide to that force. So that's the first thing. There are some broader things. Let me stop there. I think that would be the most likely path without getting too fuzzy about things.
Very good. Now, let me finish up. We've got about 4 minutes left. I want to give you an opportunity just to provide closing thoughts, but let me choose one last question here to toss out to you. Here it is. In light of public opinion supporting the Students for Fair Admissions decision, we're talking about Harvard and UNC here. Students for Fair Admissions is also suing Naval Academy and West Point, although we haven't gotten a decision in the Naval Academy trial yet. In light of public opinion supporting the SFFA decision, what would be the impact on civilian support for the military if the military academies are permitted to violate constitutional protection when no other colleges may do so? This is about, the people and our perception of the service academies, given the fact that the Students for Fair Admissions decision is very popular among the public. What is that going to do in terms of the public's view of the service academies and of the military by extension.
Jack, you want to go first?
Sure. I don't think it would help, but what really instills public confidence in the military is the way it performs. They're not so much concerned, I think, about accessions, although they wouldn't see a reason why the academies should do something different from Harvard and UNC. But again, it's all about the military's performance with the public.
I think you can cut both ways. On the one hand, yes, the trust numbers in the military have been dropping, not precipitously. We're still doing pretty well, but they are not what they were in even the recent past. And I'm not saying this without judgment, but politicians have been more willing to attack the military, particular practices or leaders therein, for reasons often related to the issues in this case. I'm not going to say that's had no effect. So I think it could. If someone wanted to use this as a cudgel, I think it would potentially be an effective cudgel. But on the other side of things, I do think that people trusting that the military is downstream of America at the end of the day. We have problems bringing people in, whether it's an obesity problem, whether it's education or drug use issues, we are downstream of America. So if these policies are seen as an attempt to level the playing field, to provide opportunities for people who would not receive them otherwise, it could be seen to increase the level of trust. As soon as we're seen as the military is seen as the preserve of a particular group of people, particularly if you go back to some of the historical criticisms of the military as exploiting a working class, as opposed to being a source of opportunity for a broader cross-section of America, I think these could increase trust by putting the military in the position of proactively offering opportunities where folks may have been limited in where they can get them in the civilian world. But could also harm trust if used as a cudgel by saying, oh, the military cares about these things when it shouldn't. So I think it could cut either way.
Duncan and Jack, I really appreciate the conversation today. I feel like we're just getting started and we could go on and on for quite some time. It's a fun subject. All three of us having served in uniform. It's an interesting thing to sort of dive into. I'm going to continue to ruminate on the things that I've heard, and I really appreciate you sharing your thoughts with me, with the Federal Society, and with our listeners. If you have any final thoughts in the last minute that we have here, we'd love to hear them, and then I'll turn it back over to our FedSoc handlers. Jack, did you want to kick us off with any final thoughts?
I guess the bottom line is that as the court said in SFFA, eliminating racial discrimination means eliminating all of it. And the Equal Protection Clause applies without regard to any differences of race, color, or nationality. It's universal in its application, and that should guide the litigation that's ongoing.
Thank you very much, Jack. John?
I would just thank everyone for listening, and that the breadth and level of detail the military gets into with the people within it is unique. We had to decide if certain people with certain types of skin had certain problems, if they didn't grow facial hair and had to shave every day, and were they eligible for shaving waivers because of it. These are the types of things we get into that the military gets into that civilian employers do not. And while that does not allow automatic deference, and shouldn't, and not every interest is a distinct interest, it does mean that there's a meaningful conversation to be had about whether the types of policies that aren't allowed at civilian universities maybe are allowable in constitutional at academies. So thanks for everyone for listening.
Yeah, and I second John's thanks to everyone, and thank you, Devin.
Tremendous.
Thank you, Devin, yes.
Thank you all very much. Marco?
Well, thank you all for that fantastic discussion and the benefit of your time and expertise today. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I would also like to thank you, our audience, for joining us. Greatly appreciate your participation. Please stay tuned for upcoming programming and announcements at fedsoc.org and all major social media platforms at FedSoc. On that note, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.